Welcome to The Point. I'm Mindy Todd. It is the Friday News Roundup, where we discuss stories making regional headlines. First, we welcome Amy Kolb-Noyes, our new science and environment reporter. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Your debut on the Roundup.
I'm so excited.
So excited to have you here. And I know for many folks, they're just getting to meet you this morning.
Yeah, I'm very excited to be in Woods Hole and to be talking to everyone this morning. There's so much to study here in Woods Hole, so many great stories all over the Cape and the islands and the South Coast, and I'm excited to dive in.
All right, so you're first here. There's going to be a burial service at Church of the Messiah in Woods Hole for two MBL scientists this weekend. And I understand it's been a long time coming. So tell us who's being buried.
Yeah, it has been a long time coming. It's a married couple, both of whom were groundbreaking scientists. Thomas Hunt Morgan, he went by the name T.H., and he won the Nobel Prize in Physiology or Medicine back in 1933. For his work on genetics. And he studied fruit flies and how chromosomes operate. He confirmed that genes are stored in chromosomes inside cell nuclei. He died back in 1945. And his wife, Lillian Morgan, she died in 1952. She also worked at MBL, and she's an independent investigator. She was a geneticist who also worked with fruit flies, and she authored 16 solo papers in her career. So that's quite a bit. Mm-hmm. And she was also the mother of four children and co-founder of the Children's School of Science in Woods Hole.
I thought that was a really interesting little bit of history that I did not know. You know, you think about that. So both T.H. and Lillian Morgan died about a half a century ago. Why are their cremains being buried now?
Well, the family lore was that they were buried outside Pasadena, California, according to Beth Trenchney. She's one of the Morgans' great-great-granddaughters. And last fall, Beth's husband, Bob, decided to surprise Beth and their two children by taking them to the mausoleum where the cremains were housed. He found the exact location on Wikipedia, except when the family went looking, the Morgans weren't there.
What do you mean, weren't there?
There were no cremains, no marker, nothing.
So where were they?
Well, it turns out the cremains were in a separate vault, not open to the public or apparently even to the family. Bob Trenchney called it perpetual care, but it sounds like the cremains had just gone unclaimed all this time, and Beth and her cousins had to go through a lot of legal red tape to take possession of them.
So T.H. Morgan also worked at Columbia and Caltech. So why did the family choose to lay them to rest here in Woods Hole?
Well, Beth says Woods Hole feels like home to the Morgan family. It's where she was told her great-great-grandparents were the happiest. Generations of Morgans have spent their summers here. Many of them attended the Children's School of Science. And T.H.'s Nobel medal and diploma are housed at MBL. So Beth said they feel like they're bringing T.H. and Lillian home when they bury them here. And she said they're having a big family reunion this weekend, and it's all planned around this burial Saturday morning.
Yeah, and I understand that the gravestone has some unusual markings.
Yes, that's true. If folks want to go see the grave, they'll find it just outside the MBL section of the Woods Hole Village Cemetery. The top of the stone is adorned with an engraving of the Nobel Medal in one corner, and on the other corner there is a fly.
A fruit fly?
Well, that was the original intent, but no, the memorial company told the family they couldn't carve a fruit fly, so it's actually a house fly. But Beth says she hopes the scientists of Woods Hole will understand and be kind about that.
Right, and you can see the Nobel Prize at the library. I've seen it. It's on great display there.
It's
worth visiting for sure.
Absolutely.
Yeah, lots of cool stuff.
And the diploma that comes with it, they're each are handcrafted by an artist, and so they're all one of a kind, and that's worth checking out as well.
All right, CAI Science and Environment reporter Amy Kolb-Noyes. Thank you, Amy.
Thank you.
Revolution Wind gets a stop work order, and joining us, Ethan Gettner from the Vineyard Gazette. Hi, Ethan.
Hey, Mindy. How are you?
Good. And Jason Graziadei from the Nantucket Current. Hi, Jason.
Good morning.
So, Ethan, this is a bit of a surprise. Isn't this like nearly 80% complete?
Yeah, this wind farm was almost done. 45 of the 65 turbines were completed when the stop work order came down last Friday. And I think it did catch a lot of folks kind of by surprise. President Donald Trump is no friend to wind, and that's not really surprising, but a lot of people thought projects that had kind of made it through the pipeline and had already been approved would be safe, kind of from changes going on.
Yeah. And Jason, this was supposed to provide power for what, Rhode Island and Connecticut, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And I'm sure, Jason, there's a ton of speculation as to what this might mean for Vineyard Wind.
Yeah, I think that was when the news came down. You know, Nantucket has been obviously more focused on Vineyard Wind and the impacts of that project. And so when we saw what happened with Revolution Wind, you know, that was sort of the immediate question. What does it mean for Vineyard Wind, given that, you know, Vineyard Wind is very much in a similar position, maybe not 80% complete, but certainly fully permitted, under construction, and in a similar place as Revolution Wind. So the question being is this a sort of precursor, and are we going to see a similar stop work order for Vineyard Wind? You know, certainly the group Act for Wales, which has been opposing Vineyard Wind, you know, from the start here, the local group on Nantucket, you know, said that, you know, they're hopeful that, this means more of these orders will ensue, and that, you know, they have this sort of same set of issues that the administration, the Trump administration, identified with Revolution Wind, is the same for Vineyard Wind. So they are hopeful. I'm not sure, you know, it's really interesting to see that versus what happened with Empire Wind, where it was stop work order and then some deal making happened with the governor there, and it's back under construction. So there's really sort of this haphazard approach with different projects that we've seen so far under the Trump administration.
Yeah. Ethan, what did the Trump administration say as to why they did this stop work order?
They cited national security concerns, which also kind of spanned, seems to encompass trade tariff issues, foreign companies owning kind of these large energy suppliers to the U.S. That's been kind of a new tactic that the Trump administration has kind of looked at. What the exact concerns for Revolution Wind, they haven't really illuminated for us. But this was something that the Department of Commerce had said they were going to look at earlier this year. And I think, like Jason said, a lot of these projects are all owned by foreign companies. They're foreign production turbines. It's such a new industry here in the U.S. that no one really makes a lot of the supplies for this kind of projects. Mm-hmm. So we'll see kind of if this sticks, and if, like you said, if this is going to be applied to other projects that are in the similar boat.
Yeah. Ethan, what's been the reaction from folks on the Vineyard as this news came down?
It's really kind of where you fall on offshore wind in general, seemingly not really case specific to Revolution Wind. The Wampanoag tribe of Gay Head has had a lot of concerns about offshore wind energy, and especially Revolution Wind, which is 12 miles and you could be seen from the Gay Head cliffs over here. They are happy that the Trump administration is kind of taking the second look at this. You know, offshore wind supporters are saying, you know, this is kind of a thinly veiled move to try and stop something that the president has a distaste for. Not surprising where everyone's falling.
And does Revolution Wind have any recourse?
They can appeal. They can appeal the stop work order. Obviously, legal actions are being considered by Ørsted, the owner of the project. They haven't kind of really said what they're going to do yet. So we'll see what happens.
All right. Moving on to another story. Jason, you have a story about the abundance of deer on the island, perhaps feeding some with food insecurity. Tell us about that.
Yeah, this is, really a story about two major issues on the island. One being food insecurity, something that we've been reporting on for a couple years now, as well as the deer population on the island, which has grown so much that a state biologist believes that there's more than 10,000 deer on the island. And, you know, that causes a lot of issues from, you know, car accidents, the tick-borne disease issues, their disease vectors, and, you know, even to small things like nuisance problems for landscapers and gardeners. So there's a new group that is sort of taking a look at this and saying, you know, can we address both of these things, and by reducing the deer herd, by expanding hunting, could we also put a dent or help solve the food insecurity issue by providing, you know, venison and meals to islanders who are food insecure. And, you know, what would that take? Expanding hunting, doing, you know, on private property. A lot of the, you know, 60% of the island is in conservation. Can we open up certain areas outside of the normal hunting season? Could there be a facility where, you know, you could process and store deer carcasses with a commercial kitchen and a walk-in freezer and have the meat be able to be used beyond just what the hunters take for themselves? So it's really, you know, these are issues that have been discussed on Nantucket for a long time. Some of these ideas are not new, but this group wants to really sort of, given the sort of crisis that we're facing with food insecurity, given the new, you know, population numbers that we're seeing with the deer herd, is it time to take another look and really try to get some momentum behind trying to solve these issues and do something new on the island that has been talked about but never really accomplished?
Yeah, 10,000, that is a lot of deer for a small island like that.
Well, if you live out here, you know, I mean, you can't drive down Milestone or Pulpus Road without, you know, almost having a collision every night. And they're everywhere.
Yeah,
they are everywhere.
Jason Gratz today from the Nantucket Current. Thank you, Jason. Appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me on.
Ethan, you did some digging into steamship trends. What did you find?
Yeah, so for the Steamship Authority, what we've seen is there's two different rates. There's the Islander, it's called the excursion rate, for vehicles going on the ferry, and then there's the standard rate, which is what regular tourists would pay if they bring their car on the island. And what we've seen on the Vineyard route is the standard rate has kind of gone down for the last 3 years, about 6% annually, and while the excursion rate continues to grow. And so this has kind of created a budgetary concern because the standard auto tickets subsidize the excursion Islander ticket. So it's kind of creating a budgetary bind that we're kind of finding ourselves in now.
Yeah, $1.2 million downturn you reported. So there's this talk about something called dynamic fares. What are dynamic fares?
Yeah, so to kind of look at how to make sure that everything is kind of balancing here, some folks on the steamship board have brought up dynamic pricing, which is people might be more familiar with, like airlines. You know, if you want to fly to Florida in December, it might cost more than it costs to fly to Florida in August. Or people might be familiar with like Uber or ride shares, where, you know, if you want a ride home from a busy place at midnight from a bar, it might cost you more than if you're trying to get there at noon during the middle of the day. So these are kind of things they're starting to talk about, different possibilities, and those are some of the ones that were thrown out there.
Are they talking about making any changes to the excursion fares? I mean, it's like the lifeline, right, for vineyarders. You have to come over here to the doctor or whatever. Are they talking about changing the excursion fares?
Yeah, it's almost certainly probably going to go up this year or headed into next year. This was something they resisted doing for the last few years, but last year they kind of saw the writing on the wall and said, next year it's probably going up. It's not a done deal yet, but almost everybody said that, you know, the current price structure is not tenable, and, you know, we might have to look at that or other, you know, potentially caps on the amount of times you can use the excursion rate in a year. So there's a lot of things around the table right now.
All right. Ethan Gettner from the Vineyard Gazette. Thank you, Ethan.
Thanks, Mindy.
Cape Cod Healthcare says we're seeing an increase in tick activity this year in our region, but what does that mean exactly? CAI's Gilda Geis asked Dr. Stephen Rich, professor of microbiology at UMass Amherst, to break it down for us.
We've been hearing that this summer Massachusetts has seen higher than usual tick activity. You know, we hear, oh, it's a bad year for ticks. So can you kind of help break down what this means? Do we have more ticks, more tick bites? Like, what's going on?
I really don't like the idea of people referring to it as a bad tick year because we don't really know what a baseline looks like. We're operating in a world where probably for every person that gets diagnosed with Lyme disease, there's 10 people that have it and don't get diagnosed. Even the CDC recognized that. So that means that we'd have to go a long ways just in terms of detecting Lyme disease alone before we'd get close to the real number. And so when people say more people are getting bitten by ticks, I think what they're cueing on is that more people are ending up in emergency rooms and urgent cares with tick bites. Now, does that mean that more people are getting bitten or this more people are made aware? I don't know. And I don't know that I care as much about that question as whether people just know, period, that ticks are out there and they're there every year and it's a persistent problem. And whether it's a little incrementally higher or lower this year is not as important as knowing that they're out there and that there are things that you can do to keep them off you.
Why do you think Lyme disease gets more attention than all the other tick-borne illnesses?
Ticks aren't very active at this time of year. In August and September, people don't always realize that some of the lowest activity periods for the black-legged ticks or the deer tick that transmits Lyme disease. But coming up in October, 50%, fully 50% of the ticks, half of the ticks, one in two of the ticks that bite you will be infected with Lyme disease. So in terms of scope, it's a bigger problem. There are more cases of Lyme disease every year, new cases of Lyme disease, than there are HIV AIDS, for example. So it's a huge number, and all the other tick-borne diseases, which are also important, but they pale in comparison when it comes to numbers.
This summer, there was that high-profile case of Powassan virus on Martha's Vineyard, tragically in an infant. You know, the mother told the newspapers she had taken the baby out for a 10-minute walk on an island bike path, and that's when the baby got the tick. And so I think for a lot of people, this story was like pretty unsettling. How do you think the general public should balance being safe and smart about ticks with also like being able to enjoy a nice day outside?
You said it like tragedy. This is absolutely a tragedy. But I would say that what we've seen and the work that we do where we test ticks that have bitten people, among the 30 plus individuals that we've seen bitten by ticks that are positive for Powassan virus over the years, none of them ended up with a symptomology that's associated with encephalitis or the kind of symptoms that this tragic case came to. So it's much like West Nile virus, which is a mosquito-borne disease. We hear all about it all the time. What people don't realize is that many of us get West Nile virus and it's of no consequence. It doesn't manifest any kind of disease in us. And then there are those instances like the tragic case with the Powassan where people get terribly sick. But they're very much the tip of the iceberg. And many more people are getting exposed to Powassan virus than are getting sick from Powassan virus. And again, it's not to take away from those tragic events where you have these just grave outcomes. But I think one has to kind of incorporate those real data into assessing what the risk is on a daily basis.
Anything else you want to add that you think people should know?
There are things that you can do to keep ticks from getting to that point where they're going to transmit. If you wear permethrin-treated clothing, is one very good way to go about it. So there's an acaricide that you spray in your clothing, or you can buy clothing that has it already impregnated into the fabric. That kills ticks on contact. Or you can think about wearing a repellent, like the ones that you'd use to repel mosquitoes, things containing DEET or picaridin. Or you can just think about wearing, you know, long pants and that kind of thing, which is always a great idea in the summer, but it can keep ticks off.
That's Dr. Stephen Rich, professor of microbiology at UMass Amherst. Stephen, thank you so much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
More about Dr. Rich's work and tick safety at our website, capeandislands.org. Coming up after a break, the Coast Guard throttles back on its buoy plan. You're listening to the Regional News Roundup on The Point. Lots of controversy over the Coast Guard's plan to remove some navigational buoys. Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle has more on that story. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Mindy.
So tell us a little bit what the Coast Guard is saying now. They've received, what, about 3,000 responses to their plan?
Yeah, they got quite a few comments on this proposal to remove quite a few buoys. Actually, the changes stretch from all the way from the Canadian border down to the Mid-Atlantic. But off the Cape, they've proposed to remove quite a number of buoys, including, I think, five off of Chatham. After getting so many responses, so many comments, the Coast Guard decided that they would sort of throttle back a little bit and review the comments and re-advertise the proposal sometime this fall, providing, they said they would provide more information and have another 8-week public comment period. And after that, they could have further, if there are further changes, there could be further public comment after that. They haven't set any specific dates on those re-advertisements or public comment periods, but they're still saying that they plan to modernize their coastal buoy system sometime next year during calendar year 2026.
So the idea is to modernize. What's the complaint that many people have about this plan?
Well, the Coast Guard side of things is that they feel that, you know, with smartphones and GPS and electronics, there really isn't a need for so many buoys. And they think that removing those would allow them to deliver a more effective and economical service. That's what they say. Local harbor masters and mariners say that this just isn't the case, that basically there are a lot of mariners in this area don't have extensive electronics on their vessels. You know, obviously the commercial fishermen and vessels that are inspected regularly by the Coast Guard, they would have the this equipment. But, you know, if you just have a small whaler or something like that, you're not going to have a ton of GPS equipment and other electronics on board. And, you know, the Chatham Harbor Master told us that he's worried that this could be a safety problem because people, you know, they may be able to find buoys, but if they don't have the electronics and there's no buoys around, they could really be lost right offshore, you know, especially in this area where we tend to have fog roll in very unexpectedly. And it could can confuse boaters at times.
Yeah. So I guess the plan could stay the same, but it's basically they're allowing for more public input is what this is about, right?
Yeah, basically they're delaying things so they can get more public input. Right. They proposed this a number of years ago, and they ended up not going through with it. So we'll see if this time they follow through.
And year-round residents in Chatham getting a pretty good size reduction in their property taxes.
Yeah, the select board voted to give year-round residents who are living in owner-occupied homes a 35% reduction in their property taxes. It won't go into effect until fiscal 2027, which begins in July next year. But the board felt that this is something that's allowed under state law. It's been adopted by 10 other communities on the Cape and Islands and 11 others across the state, including Boston. And it basically is an opportunity to give local year-round residents some kind of break on their property taxes. You know, housing is a major cost around here. And the select board felt that this could help some year-rounders stay in their homes. There was some pushback from the summer residents in town and at least one member of the select board who felt that this was it's not fair because it shifts the property tax burden to the non-resident taxpayers. But the counter was that, you know, part of the reason that housing prices are so high here is because of non-resident property owners. And so that maybe they should shoulder a little bit more of the property tax burden.
Right. And then finally, Harwich could see amplified music banned from all establishments.
That's a threat that sort of was made a week or so ago by the board when they were entertaining a request from a couple of downtown Harwich Port restaurants to sort of reinstate outdoor amplified music that had been banned following noise complaints a while ago. The attorney for Ember and Port said that it's not fair that those restaurants don't have amplified outdoor music when other establishments right around them do have it. And, you know, they said it creates an unfair economic advantage for those other establishments. But the board of select board is sort of taking a hard line on this and saying, you know, this is part of the reason we have noise complaints. And, you know, Harwich Port is a tight area with a lot of residences right up against businesses. And they're wary about allowing too much outdoor amplified music. So there was no decision made, but it was clear that board members weren't going to sort of follow through on just sort of granting permits willy-nilly.
All right, more to come on that one. All right, Tim Wood from the Cape Cod Chronicle. Thank you, Tim.
Thank you, Mindy.
All right, let's check in on State House News now. CAI's Gilda Geist talk with our State House reporter, Katie Lannon.
Earlier this year, Massachusetts Attorney General Andrea Campbell sued the Trump administration for freezing education funding. What was the Trump administration's reasoning for freezing that funding, and what was at stake for Massachusetts students?
Yeah, this is a pool of money that included $108 million for Massachusetts schools. And the Trump administration said that they were reviewing the programs funded by this money to make sure they were in line with the president's priorities. it's an array of programs that were covered here, including after school and summer programs, support for the children of migrant agricultural and fishery workers, teacher services, supports, help for English learners. There's really an array of programs that state officials were warning might need to be canceled as the school year approached.
So where does the lawsuit stand now?
The Attorney General's office announced this week that after part of that money was already made available, but the rest of the money will need to be made available to Massachusetts and the other states involved in this lawsuit by October. And that is after the Attorney Generals of the various states secured an agreement from the Trump administration that isn't admitting that they did anything wrong here in holding this money back from the states, but agreed that they are ultimately going to release it, so it stops the lawsuit from progressing any further.
And in other back-to-school education news, the Education Committee on Beacon Hill is considering a bill that would make start times for middle and high school students later. So who is behind this bill, and what is their reasoning for proposing it?
This is backed by an organization called Start School Later, whose premise I think is right there in the name. The local chapter here in Massachusetts is led by a school committee member out in Westwood in the Boston area. And the group cites research that says later school start times for older students are linked to better mental health, reduced rates of depression, improved physical health as well because of the lack of sleep deprivation. Because these older kids are really on a schedule where they are sleeping later naturally. So the idea is that they can even do better in school if they're able to keep with their body's natural rhythms a little better.
What do opponents of the bill have to say about it?
Yeah, this is something that has been proposed before on Beacon Hill and hasn't gotten a ton of traction in the State House, in part because it's really complicated to bus kids of various ages to school if they need the same school buses to send, say, elementary schoolers and high schoolers to class at the same time of day. They're going to need more buses. That's going to cost districts more money. And then there's questions about when extracurricular activities would manage to be fit into families' busy days if there are later school starts times. The elementary school piece of the puzzle is really a big one because if they switched so those students who are naturally up earlier start their school days earlier, there'd be more times that parents would need to watch those younger kids at the end of the day, and that might be tough on people's work schedules.
All right, complicated issue. We'll see where it goes. That's Katie Lannon from the State House. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We're finding out just what the conditions have been like for some detained by ICE. New Bedford Light reporters Kevin Andrade and Eleonora Bianca have been looking into this and join us with the details. Good morning, Kevin and Eleonora.
Good morning.
Hi, good morning.
So you found some pretty harsh conditions. Give us some examples of what you found.
So one of the conditions that was really striking was for Judy Melissa Aguiliano Romero, who is a Honduran asylum seeker. She was taken into custody by ICE for more than 70 days, and she was held at Burlington, the ICE field office, for 11 days. While there, she said that she ended up not being able to eat because the food just caused nausea. And she even had to, whenever they gave her a sandwich, she'd often cut it into four pieces in order to be able to eat something over the next several meal times. Juan Francisco Mendez, who is the man from several months back whose window got smashed by federal agents, when he was in detention at Stratford County Detention Facility in Dover, New Hampshire, he said that he was never allowed outside and that the only sunlight that inmates were really able to get was a reflection through a slit in one of the areas of their wing of the prison. And he called it a memory of sunlight. Inmates would sit in there just to receive the memory of sunlight.
Mm. Eleonora, you also found that basic necessities were not being provided, right?
Correct, yes. We
we spoke with her, with them, and most of them, they said that the food was pretty scarce. Medical attention was also not present every time, and they also more in general, they were transported to different facilities, so they were away from family members, lawyers, and something else that they told us that they most of the times they didn't know what time of the day it was or what mm-hmm. day.
And didn't they weren't some of them not allowed shower facilities? They were drinking from toilets. I mean, there was some just really awful conditions that you found. And I'm wondering, comparing the different facilities, you looked at, you know, Burlington, Vermont, New Hampshire, Texas, Louisiana. Were they similar?
So conditions vary from facility to facility, but there are some general themes. One, Burlington was across the board an awful experience for most of the detainees. One of them, Emerson Garcia dos Santos, she said, Burlington foi um inferno, Burlington was hell. When we spoke with Jury Melissa Aguirre Romero, she said that compared to Burlington, Chittenden was a great experience. Great is relative, mm-hmm. of course. You tend to find that where the facilities in the south, you know, further south, like in Texas and Louisiana, tend to have worse off conditions. For example, Andres de Leon Castro described not having regular access to potable water and being forced to drink out of that toilet sink contraption whenever he wanted drinkable water. And if he wanted to go to get bottled water, you'd have to pay $2.50 at the prison commissary for this tiny little thing. Mm. So, you know, it's tended to be if it was an ICE facility, the conditions were a little bit worse than the state facilities, especially in North and South, and if they were a private facility.
Mm. And what about pressures to sign self-deportation orders? Did they find that they were being pressured to do that?
Well, in one case, we found that they said that they were pressured. They were brought to a room and they were pressured, yelled at, in order to sign these deportation papers. And in one case, they said that they didn't even know what they were saying because it wasn't. It wasn't in Spanish, so they were given information. They were pressured to sign these papers, and I think it was Castro in the story. He said that he signed the papers.
Mm. What's been the response to the article? I'm wondering, in particular, from political leaders, has there been any response to what you're reporting?
So I have not heard anything from political leaders. Multiple media outlets have reached out to us and expressed interest in speaking further about this, including WCAI. Mm-hmm. But I have not heard anything from political leaders at this point.
Yeah. How about you, Eleanor?
No, me neither.
New Bedford Light reporters Kevin Andrade and Eleanor Bianca, thank you so much, and thanks for looking into that. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Have a great day.
You too. Coming up after the break, opportunities for local songwriters.
Well, then there come times when you're trying to get somewhere and there's not a whole lot of wind and you're too lazy to put the mainsail up.
Vineyarder Eric Kipp.
We'll get this 30-some-odd-year-old flathead Atomic 4 engine, which is a marinized tractor engine made in Oshkosh, Wisconsin. But they don't make them anymore. I'm going to rebuild this. Get the fan going because it's gas. And ignition. Gear. Full throttle. Push this Toyota.
You're listening to the Cape and Islands NPR stations.
Glad to have her aboard.
You're listening to the News Roundup on The Point, and it seems there's a dispute over the interpretation of rules for accessory dwelling units on the Cape Cod National Seashore. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent has more on that story. Hi, Ed.
Hi, Mindy.
So interpretation is everything, right? Tell us what the two different sides are saying.
Okay, so affordable dwelling units is the subject of a lot of interest right now because of the passage of the new state law, the Affordable Homes Act, which was passed last year and provides that ADUs, so-called, are allowed by right in districts zoned for single-family residences. Now, the Cape Cod National Seashore, when it was established by federal legislation in 1961, allowed for existing single-family homes to continue under private ownership. And there's several hundred of them, around 600 in the seashore, most of them in the towns of Wellfleet, Truro, and Eastham. And there's differing interpretations about the applicability of this law that was passed by the state, because the National Seashore Superintendent, Jennifer Flynn, has said that ADUs are not authorized under the federal standards that were established in 1961 for land use because they prohibit two dwellings on one lot. And that's what an ADU really is. It's a second dwelling on a single lot. But what's happened is that Wellfleet's land use attorney, Beth Piles, told the Wellfleet Select Board on August 19th that her interpretation was that they were allowed because they're accessory uses, and accessory uses are specifically allowed in the park. And the Select Board then voted to instruct the town's representatives on the Cape Cod National Seashore Advisory Commission to take that position going forward. And there's a similar thing has happened in Truro, where we were told by Michael Fee, who is the town's alternate on the advisory commission, that Truro believed that ADUs were allowed as long as they're in keeping with the character of the district. And their view is that the seashore's position is overly restrictive and not accurate.
So where does the dispute go from here?
Well, it's an interesting question because ultimately it's up to the individual towns to enforce zoning rules. Wellfleet's land use attorney, Beth Piles, has recommended that Wellfleet's zoning laws be updated to reflect the new state law and make it clear that ADUs are allowed in the National Seashore. And so what would happen is if somebody who owned a property in the seashore wanted to put in an ADU, they'd have to go and get permits from the town. And probably what would happen is that the National Seashore would oppose them, and it would be up to the local zoning authorities to decide what to do about it. If they give permission for them, the potential result of that is that those property owners would lose their certificates of suspension of condemnation, and their properties would be subject to taking by eminent domain by the seashore. But there's a big but there, which is eminent domain law requires the payment of fair market value for any such taking, and the National Park Service doesn't have any money to do that.
Yeah, so I'm sure more to come on this story. Ed Miller from the Provincetown Independent. Thank you, Ed.
You're welcome. Thanks, Mindy.
The Asian longhorn beetle was first discovered in the United States in Brooklyn in 1996. It's since found its way to Illinois, New Jersey, Massachusetts, and Ohio. It's believed to have made its way to the U.S. inside wood packaging material from Asia, where it is a serious pest of hardwood trees. Two separate infestations have been found in Massachusetts, the first in Worcester in 2008 and the second in Boston in 2010. So far, none have been reported on the Cape and Islands. If efforts in central Mass tests are successful, this invasive species may be eradicated from the state. Sam Turkin has more.
The hunt for the Asian longhorned beetle starts early in the morning. Today, in Shrewsbury, near Lake Quinsigamond. Matt Schreiner looks up at a lanky poplar tree, game planning his climb.
Every tree is different.
How many times have you done this?
Over 10,000.
Schreiner's a full-time tree climber with the State Department of Conservation and Recreation. That's right, a tree climber. It's a real position.
Sounds like a pretty good job.
There's nothing like climbing a tree, having a sip of an iced coffee at 80 feet.
You're drinking a Dunkin' iced coffee in the tree?
I drink heroic amounts of coffee.
Schreiner makes the job look easy, even though he says it's not. Wearing a helmet, he uses rope to start hoisting himself up the tree. His mission, scan for eggs laid by the inky black beetle with white spots.
He's looking on top of the branches, he's looking underneath the branches on all sides.
Felicia Eubach watches the hunt from down below. She's a forest health specialist with the state, and she says the Asian longhorned beetles, they leave dimples in the bark when they lay their eggs. After hatching, the larvae move deeper into the tree. They eat its core for over a year till they become adults. Then they chew their way out of the trunk, leaving behind exit holes the size of a dime.
That's a lot of tunnels in the trunk, which weakens and stress out the tree. So, you know, good rainstorm, windstorm, it could knock the tree over.
Maples, poplars, willows, elms, they're the common victims. The state cares so much because the bug, it threatens our maple syrup and timber industries, can ruin habitats, even compromise public safety if trees start falling down.
We think that we can eradicate this insect. It's slow, it's not moving very quickly. You're lucky if it's gonna fly a mile or 2 miles.
Tree looks clean. No signs of Asian longhorn beetle.
That's Schreiner, the tree climber. One tree down, about 10 more to go today. That's the thing about this whole process. It is long, it is arduous. At least 25,000 infested trees have been tossed into the wood chipper over the years. It all seems to be working. Staff haven't seen any new sign of the bug since 2021. And yet, they need to spend several more years scanning just to make sure there are no more beetles. State forest workers also search on foot using binoculars. They laugh about having strong necks because of all the looking up. They also look down. If you're allergic to poison ivy or want absolutely nothing to do with ticks, yeah, this isn't the job for you.
I've been in days where I've been out there and you pull off, like on your pants, 30, 40, 50 ticks. As you can see, a lot of us tuck on our pants into our socks.
Matt Rich leads a team of ground surveyors. Despite the obstacles, they love being in nature every day. And they say it's bittersweet. The state's beetle program is reaching its final stages. That's especially true for Rich. He's hunted the beetle for over a decade.
I'll be technically out of a job. Always on the back of my mind.
Still, Rich and other forest workers, they don't want to dwell on the negative. This is a success story, they say, and they're eager to see it through. In Shrewsbury, I'm Sam Turkin, GBH News.
When Falmouth resident and musician Lily Raposa returned to her hometown last year, she longed for the music community that she had found at college in Tennessee. So she decided to create it in Falmouth. It's called Songbird Collective, and it provides opportunities for local songwriters to showcase their work. CAI's Gilda Dice spoke with Raposa recently to learn more about it.
How did you come up with the idea to start Songbird Collective?
So I grew up in Falmouth, Mass., and when I went to college at Belmont University in Nashville, Tennessee, and I went for songwriting and audio engineering, and then I came back last year to Falmouth. I noticed that there was a stark difference in the music scene in between Falmouth and Music City, Nashville, Tennessee. It was quite shocking to me because I had gotten so used to being in a place where there was music everywhere. And I had gotten so used to being in a place where songwriters had avenues of expressing themselves. And I came back home and I didn't see any songwriting situation anywhere. I didn't see any outlet for songwriters. Like, we don't really have a venue here in Falmouth. We have like bars that are set up with some sound equipment, but it's not what I would call a venue because it's more about the drinking than it is about the music. And there's definitely like places for that. There's places for playing music and drinking and having fun. But I was looking for more of a listening room. There are so many of those in Nashville, and there aren't any here. And so I had an idea to create something kind of inspired by So Far Sounds and Tiny Desk Concert and the Bluebird Cafe, which is pretty famous for discovering Taylor Swift. The first couple of shows were just me and whoever I knew that could play guitar and sing. And then as it started to kind of take off, people reached out to me, and there were friends of friends who were musicians that wanted to play. And I started getting people from Instagram, and people in the audience had family members or friends who were songwriters or played. Now I hardly even really have to go looking on my own for people to play, which is really, really nice.
Can you kind of take us through what Songbird Collective looks like right now?
We're holding two shows a month right now. We're doing the second Thursday of every month at the Daily Brew Coffee House and Lounge in North Falmouth. And we are doing the last Saturday of every month at Coffee Obsession Falmouth location. The shows are set up in two different ways. In the Falmouth location, we have three songwriters playing 30-minute sets of their original music. The show is about 2 hours with breaks included, and we also have drinks to sell, and we have merch to look at, and so it's a whole event, but the music is the main focus. There's a different setup for Daily Brew. At the Daily Brew, what we're doing right now, we just had our first show, and it was a huge success. We sold like 88 tickets. It's set up in a writer's round Nashville style, so we have three songwriters up on stage at the same time. And each of the songwriters goes through playing one of their songs, and then they start from the beginning again. We do that for about 40 minutes, and then we have a small break, and then we do it for another 40 minutes. We pay songwriters based on ticket sales, and then I also have like Venmo QR code tip jars that serve also as cash tip jars for them. They're also welcome to bring their merch and set it up. We also hire a photographer to come and take high quality, incredible, wonderful edited pictures. And then we also have this video production team that is taking videos of their performance and uploading it and promoting it.
When did you start this? This is like the first year of it, right?
Yes. So I would say probably around this time last year, I had my first show. So it's been a whole year of Songbird Collective, and it's been a totally wild ride. It's just been so fun. I've made so many connections and friends from it. And the whole point of Songbird Collective is to build a community and to build a listening community. And I feel like I've done that, which is pretty awesome.
That's Lily Raposa, musician and founder of Songbird Collective. Lily, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
And that's Levi Cooper on guitar at a Songbird Collective show. To learn more about Songbird Collective, visit our website, capeandislands.org. And that wraps up this week's News Roundup. I'm Mindy Todd. Thanks for listening.